Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. Now, I want to thank you for tuning in this evening, and you can thank yourself for what you're about to learn. And as always, be ready to take lots of notes. Now, first, the cursory information. If you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, or HOT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com, that's hourofthetime.com. My personal email address to share research, suggestions for topics on the air, hate mail, questions, what have you. hourofthetime@hotmail.com, hourofthetime@hotmail.com, and the studio number in Arizona, 928-333-2942. That's 928-333-2942. And in Canada, the studio, 613-733-4324. 613-733-4324. Now this evening, the 12th of February, 2010, is part 3 in our series on the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're taking lots of notes, because papers like this, written by professors, are disappearing rampantly. Now, I made some offers the other night, and some of you were very astute and took advantage of them, and now you have archives and a 40-something page bibliography to go after and keep doing some more research and reading. Because things like this are disappearing, being edited down in smaller formats, etc. This one, we can thank Professors Mearsheimer and Professors Walt of the John F. Kennedy School of Government and the University of Chicago for this paper. And I found that it wasn't so much the paper, although it's a wonderful piece, how it tied things together in a short, concise manner, but just as well, the London Review of Books covered it, and of course, it was lambasted almost immediately, but the bibliography, the endnotes, footnotes, and bibliography, 42 pages long, in very small type, mind you, led to hundreds of hours of more research and reading. I found that to be the real value in the piece, but we have to thank those professors and give them full credit for this piece. And it ties in directly with the series that I just finished on Zionist violations. Now in that, you can go to the hourofthetime.com and go to our website shopping cart, which is the Hot Shop. And there you'll see bundled series that are in a topical manner, like Zionist violations. Soon, when this series is done, it'll be as a bundled package. And hundreds of individual MP3 broadcasts, but these two series, along with Bill's series on the ADL, all make a wonderful package. So I would suggest you get the ADL series, you get the Zionist Violations package, and in that package, because I want you to see, as always, how the Hour of the Time documents, we have over 80 documents that I gathered from the United Nations that were referenced in that particular series as part of the bundled package. So the MP3 broadcast and the documents. Don't believe me what I said on the air. Go read the whole document yourself. Each of the 80-plus documents. It's all there. The ADL series, because we're listener-supported, ladies and gentlemen. And there's donations, outright donations, of course, are greatly appreciated. But we also like to, I think better yet even, is when you donate. Granted, there's overhead involved then, but when you donate for research materials, get something that you can study and research. And let's get a solution out there, ladies and gentlemen. That is what we are about, solution-oriented and taking a proactive stance here at Hour of the Time and documentation. Now, when this series is done, a wonderful package would be, I would suggest for the researcher, this entire series, which tonight is part three in it, the Israel lobby and the U.S. foreign policy and its impact and effects, the ADL series and the Zionist Violation series. And of course, it ties in the bigger picture with several others. That's why they're bundled together, to help you in your research. It ties in with the Mystery Babylon series 1, 2, and 3 to a great extent. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we will take our cursory, as we always do, musical break at the beginning for you to get settled in, get your snacks, something to write with, etc. You're going to have lots of notes to take again. Names, dates, locations, acts, official programs. And I help you along with your notes as well by giving you kind of heading classifications. So right after this musical break, be prepared for this evening, February the 12th, 2010, Friday, for part three in our series on the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. Thanks to Professors Mearsheimer and Professors Walt of the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and at University of Chicago. Ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time, the only network where you'll get information like this and documentation like this. People shy away from these topics because they're scared. And if you really want to work for a solution, you need to overcome that fear, ladies and gentlemen. Because it isn't just one group or just one race, if you will, like some of you insist upon. It is a quagmire of people and backgrounds and entities and societies, ranging from non-government organizations to the esoteric. So you need a well-rounded research education to understand the enemy at large also. Now we'll give a brief recap where we ended from the last broadcast, part two. Tonight is part three in this series. And this could be in your notes as we had started at the end of the last series. It could be the lobby, if you will. And that's how it was referred to throughout the first two broadcasts. And you might, under this heading that you started before, influencing Congress. But a brief recap at first. It is AIPAC itself, however, that forms the core of the lobby's influence in Congress. AIPAC's success is due to its ability to reward legislators and congressional candidates who support its agenda, and to punish those who challenge it. Money is critical to U.S. elections. Simply look at the scandal over lobbyist Jack Abramoff's various shady dealings, if you need a reminder. And AIPAC makes sure that its friends get strong financial support from the myriad pro-Israel political action committees. Those seen as hostile to Israel, on the other hand, can be sure that AIPAC will direct campaign contributions to their political opponents. AIPAC also organizes letter-writing campaigns and encourages newspaper editors to endorse pro-Israel candidates. There is no doubt about the potency of these tactics. To take but one example, in 1984, AIPAC helped defeat Senator Charlie Percy of Illinois, who, according to one prominent lobby figure, had, quote, displayed insensitivity and even hostility to our concerns, end quote. Thomas Dine, the head of AIPAC at the time, explained what happened. Quote, all the Jews in America, from coast to coast, gathered to oust Percy. And the American politicians, those who hold public positions now, and those who aspire, got the message. End quote. AIPAC prizes, ladies and gentlemen, its reputation as a formidable adversary, of course, because it discourages anyone from questioning its agenda. Now, I'd like to also point out, ladies and gentlemen, digressing here slightly, that you see the problem that's created out there in this myriad world of so-called research, Patriot Facts Networks, Facts Just In, and most of the other bullshit you hear out there, is that lumping together. And here, Thomas Dine, the head of AIPAC at the time of this campaign against Senator Percy, did it himself even. See, these groups, as we pointed out in the previous broadcast in this series, don't represent all Jews. That's pretty obvious. Yet he said, quote, all the Jews in America from coast to coast gathered to oust Percy, end quote. That is a lie, ladies and gentlemen, because I personally know and work with Jews as public relations officers, etc., that are of our property group that has stunning victories all the way to the recent victories in the Ninth Circuit Court with my legal writings. And they are intimately loyal to the Constitution and the Republic. And know that the behavior of AIPAC is ill. I discuss these very topics with them bluntly. And there are thousands like that. But see, this lumping together is what's so sadly humorous. Because I had already pointed out in a previous broadcast this very case and this quote and how it's been skewed by their own head of the AIPAC, lying through his teeth. He doesn't help the situation because it's part of controlled opposition, ladies and gentlemen. It's a fifth column, controlled opposition. And it is meant to heartily divide, as you see right now with the Tea Party Express, absolute crap. Sarah Palin, crap. Ron Paul, crap. McCain, crap. You are seeing some very powerful elements right there in political action committees registered in Washington, ladies and gentlemen, buying each other up, forming umbrella groups, splintering off what had become a good grassroots movement at one time, and destroying it on several fronts. And that is the reason for statements like this. Now back to the writings of these wonderful professors. AIPAC's influence on Capitol Hill goes even farther, however. According to Douglas Bloomfield, a former AIPAC staff member, quote, "It is common for members of Congress and their staffs to turn to AIPAC first when they need information, before calling the Library of Congress, the Congressional Research Service, committee staff, or administration experts." End quote. More importantly, he notes that AIPAC is, quote, "often called upon to draft speeches, work on legislation, advise on tactics, perform research, collect co-sponsors, and marshal votes." End quote. David Bloomfield, former AIPAC staff member. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as I was saying earlier, these, if you took us up on our offer during the live broadcast the last two evenings, you can see these references and go read it for yourself. These are quotes are not taken out of context. That's why I love that quote about all Jews from coast to coast. Because he's a blatant liar. That's Thomas Dine. This last quote was Douglas Bloomfield. And that goes on a lot, ladies and gentlemen. Now somebody, as I was alluding to earlier, but someone was banging on the door, so I got a little sidetracked while I was talking here. But somebody already emailed me about the last series and these quotes and stuff, saying that I was blaming everything on the Jews. Well, I categorically read that these professors didn't do that either. We've been quite clear on the names, groups, organizations, dates, activities. And if you can't take the documentation and listen to it, listening's different than hearing. And if you're going to run around with rectal cranial inversion, don't come bitching to me in an email. I don't want to hear it. They said it. I didn't say it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the bottom line is that AIPAC, which is a de facto agent for a foreign government, has a stranglehold on the U.S. Congress. Open debate about U.S. policy towards Israel does not occur there, even though that policy has important consequences for the entire world. Thus, one of the three main branches of the U.S. government is firmly committed to supporting Israel. As former Senator Ernest Hollings, Democrat of South Carolina, noted as he was leaving office, quote, "You can't have an Israeli policy other than what AIPAC gives you around here." End quote. Small wonder, ladies and gentlemen, that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon once told an American audience then, huh? Quote, "When people ask me how they can help Israel, I tell them Help AIPAC. End quote. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the hour of the time, 12th February, 2010, Friday. The website, hourofthetime.com. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. And the studio numbers. In Arizona, 928-333-2942. And in Canada, 613-733-4324. And ladies and gentlemen, don't forget that we're listener supported. Fully. And we're on paid staff, mind you. All of it goes to the operation. Because I doubt we'll be getting any grants from AIPAC anytime soon. So it's up to you. Now this next section I would definitely call Influencing the Executive, still under the lobby, if you will. The lobby also has significant leverage over the executive branch. That power derives in part from the influence Jewish voters have on presidential elections. Despite their small numbers in the population, less than 3%, they make large campaign donations to candidates from both parties. The Washington Post once estimated that Democratic presidential candidates, quote, depend on Jewish supporters to supply as much as 60% of the money, end quote. Furthermore, as a demographic segment, I would say, Jewish voters have high turnout rates and are concentrated in key states like California, Florida, Illinois, New York, and Pennsylvania. Because they matter in close elections, presidential candidates go to great lengths not to antagonize Jewish voters. And ladies and gentlemen, all you have to do is look at the three-page spill that the recent hoodoo, blue blah, race of Senator Brown, and all the ruckus that was made about it. But I have the three-page letter he wrote concerning these groups that we're talking about right now. He made sure to pander and cater to them as a key component of his election. I would disagree with the professors on one sentence here. It's kind of a chicken and the egg scenario again. There's a lot of that. They say that the Jewish voters are concentrated in key states, but I would say that they made, in a lot of cases, these key states because they do have such, as a demographic segment of society, such an ardent and high turnout at the elections. So just a flip-flop of the direction. I doubt they moved there because it was a key state. They helped create it and make it a key state because of their potency in the booth. But that's neither here nor there. To continue on, key organizations in the lobby also directly target the administration in power. For example, pro-Israel forces make sure that critics of the Jewish state do not get important foreign policy appointments. Jimmy Carter, for instance, wanted to make, excuse me, Jimmy Carter, for instance, wanted to make George Ball his first Secretary of State. But he knew that Ball was perceived as critical of Israel and that the lobby would oppose the appointment. This litmus test forces any aspiring policymaker to become an overt supporter of Israel, which is why public critics of Israeli policy have become an endangered species in the U.S. foreign policy establishment. And ladies and gentlemen, these constraints still operate today. When 2004 presidential candidate Howard Dean called for the United States to make a more even-handed role in the Arab-Israeli conflict, Senator Joseph Lieberman, communist, accused him of selling Israel down the river and said his statement was, quote unquote, irresponsible. Virtually all of the top Democrats in the House signed a hard-hitting letter to Dean criticizing his comments. And the Chicago Jewish Star reported that, quote, anonymous attackers are clogging the email inboxes of Jewish leaders around the country, warning, without much evidence, that Dean would somehow be bad for Israel. End quote. Now I want you to listen to that again, ladies and gentlemen, from the Chicago Jewish Star. Quote, anonymous attackers are clogging the email inboxes of Jewish leaders around the country, warning, without much evidence, that Dean would somehow be bad for Israel. End quote. Now, as we stated at the beginning of this series, these doctors had to thank, for the most part, Israel research institutes, reporters, think tanks, political action groups for this research. Because it's not talked about here, ladies and gentlemen. Now, to continue on, though, with this piece, what's so ironic about this whole story, ladies and gentlemen, was the whole worry was absurd because Dean was known and is, in fact, quite hawkish on Israel. His campaign co-chair was a former AIPAC president, and Dean said his own views on the Middle East more closely reflected those of AIPAC than the more moderate Americans for Peace Now, and that's a group. Dean said his own views on the Middle East more closely reflected those of AIPAC than the more moderate Americans for Peace Now. But you see the attack he came under because he simply, merely suggested to bring these sides together. Washington should act as an honest broker. It's hardly a radical idea, ladies and gentlemen. But it is the antithesis of the lobby. The lobby, which does not tolerate the idea of even-handedness when it comes to Arab-Israeli conflict. The lobby's goals, you see, are also served when pro-Israel individuals occupy important positions in the executive branch. During the Clinton administration, for example, Middle East policy was largely shaped by officials with close ties to Israel or to prominent pro-Israel organizations, including Martin Indyk, the former deputy director of research at AIPAC and co-founder of the pro-Israel Washington Institute for Near East Policy, WINEP. You will see a lot more about them, ladies and gentlemen, in the near future. That's why I'm pushing these series out right now. WINEP, Whiskey, India, November, Echo, Papa. It's an acronym. Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Now another one in the Clinton administration, Dennis Ross, joined WINEP after leaving government in 2001. And Aaron Miller, also involved heavily, has lived in Israel and often visits there. These men were among President Clinton's closest advisors at the Camp David summit in July 2000. Although all three supported the Oslo peace process and favored creation of a Palestinian state, they did so only within the limits of what would be acceptable to Israel. In particular, the American delegation took its cues from Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, coordinated negotiating positions in advance, and did not offer its own independent proposals for settling the conflict. And, ladies and gentlemen, not surprisingly, Palestinian negotiators, complained that they were, quote, negotiating with two Israeli teams, one displaying an Israeli flag and one an American flag.
All right.
right, ladies and gentlemen, again, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time. The website, hourofthetime.com. The studio numbers in Arizona, 928-333-2942. And in Canada, 613-733-4324. And my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you will see that the situation was even more pronounced in the Bush administration, whose ranks included fervently pro-Israel individuals like Elliot Abrams, John Bolton, Douglas Feith, I. Lewis Scooter Libby, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, and David Wormser. As we shall see, these officials consistently pushed for policies favored by Israel and backed by organizations in the lobby. Now, manipulating the media is a common tool, ladies and gentlemen. If you don't believe me, go back and read some of the wonderful works from days gone by. They don't get enough credit. But part of my suggested reading list, All the News That Fits. I think it's a must-read book. None Dare Call It Conspiracy, and The Naked Communist. All three of those are mandatory reading if you're going to be a researcher. Now, under your little note heading, subheading of manipulating the media, in addition to influencing government policy directly, the lobby strives to shape public perceptions about Israel and the Middle East. It does not want an open debate on issues involving Israel, because an open debate might cause Americans to question the level of support that they currently provide. Accordingly, pro-Israel organizations work hard to influence the media, think tanks, and academia, because these institutions are critical in shaping popular opinion. The lobby's perspective on Israel is widely reflected in the mainstream media, in good part because most American commentators are pro-Israel. The debate among Middle East pundits, journalist Eric Alterman writes, is, quote, dominated by people who can not imagine criticizing Israel, end quote. He lists 61, quote, columnists and commentators who can be counted upon to support Israel reflectively and reflexively and without qualification, end quote. Conversely, Alterman found just 5 pundits who consistently criticize Israeli behavior or endorse pro-Arab positions. Do the math, ladies and gentlemen, 5 to 61. Newspapers occasionally publish guest op-eds challenging Israeli policy, but the balance of opinion clearly favors the other side. This pro-Israel bias is reflected in the editorials of major newspapers. Robert Bartley, the late editor of the Wall Street Journal, once remarked that, quote, Shamir, Sharon, Bibi, whatever these guys want is pretty much fine by me, end quote. Not surprisingly, the Journal, along with other prominent newspapers like the Chicago Sun-Times and the Washington Times, regularly run editorials that are strongly pro-Israel. Magazines like Commentary, The New Republic, and the Weekly Standard also zealously defend Israel at every turn. Editorial bias is also found in papers, ladies and gentlemen, like the New York Times. The Times occasionally criticizes Israeli policies and sometimes concedes even that the Palestinians have legitimate grievances. But it is not even-handed. In his memoirs, for example, Former Times executive editor Max Frankel acknowledged the impact of his own pro-Israel attitude and how it affected his editorial choices. In his words, quote, "I was much more deeply devoted to Israel than I dared to assert," end quote. And he goes on to say, quote, "Fortified by my knowledge of Israel and my friendships there, I myself wrote most of our Middle East commentaries. As more Arab than Jewish readers recognized, I wrote them from a pro-Israel perspective," end quote. The media's reporting of news events involving Israel is somewhat more even-handed than editorial commentary is, in part because reporters strive to be objective, but also because it is difficult to cover events in the occupied territories without acknowledging Israel's actual behavior. To discourage unfavorable reporting on Israel, the lobby organizes letter-writing campaigns, demonstrations, and boycotts against news outlets whose content it considers anti-Israel. One CNN executive has said that he sometimes gets 6,000 email messages in a single day complaining that a story is anti-Israel. Similarly, the pro-Israel Committee for Accurate Mideast Reporting in America, CAMRA, Committee for Accurate Middle East Reporting in America, CAMRA, organized demonstrations outside National Public Radio, NPR, stations in 33 cities in May 2003. And it also tried to convince contributors to withhold support from NPR until its Middle East coverage became more sympathetic to Israel. Boston's NPR station, for instance, WBUR, Whiskey, Bravo, Uniform, Romeo, reportedly lost more than $1 million in contributions as a result of these efforts. Pressure on NPR has also come from Israel's friends in Congress, who have asked NPR for an internal audit as well as more oversight of its Middle East coverage. These factors, ladies and gentlemen, help explain why the American media contains few criticism of Israeli policy, rarely questions Washington's relationship with Israel, and only occasionally discusses the lobby's profound influence on U.S. policy. Ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley, with the Hour of the Time, Friday the 12th, February 2010, part 3 in our series on the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. Its effects, ladies and gentlemen, often detrimental to what our real interests for national security behavior should be. Now, your next section of notes, you might just call it think tanks, pro-Israel forces predominate in U.S. think tanks, which play an important role in shaping public debate as well as actual policy. The lobby created its own think tank in 1985 when Martin Indyk helped found WinEP. Although WinEP plays down its links to Israel and claims instead that it provides a balanced and realistic perspective on Middle East issues, this is simply not the case. In fact, WinEP is funded and run by individuals who are deeply committed to advancing Israel's agenda. The lobby's influence in the think tank world extends well beyond WinEP. Over the past 25 years, pro-Israel forces have established a commanding presence at the American Enterprise Institute, the Brookings Institute, the Center for Security Policy, the Foreign Policy Research Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Hudson Institute, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis, and the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, JINSA. Juliet, India, November, Sierra, Alpha, JINSA. These think tanks are decidedly pro-Israel and include few, if any, critics of U.S. support for the Jewish state. A good indicator, ladies and gentlemen, of the lobby's influence in the think tank world is the evolution of the Brookings Institution. For many years, its senior expert on Middle East issues was William B. Quandt, a distinguished academic and former NSC official with a well-deserved reputation for even-handedness regarding the Arab-Israeli conflict. And I did it again with the acronym NSC, National Security Council. Sorry about that. William Quandt again. Today, however, Brookings' work on these issues is conducted through its Sabin Center for Middle East Studies, which is financed by Haim Sabin, a wealthy Israeli-American businessman and ardent Zionist. The director of the Sabin Center is the ubiquitous Martin Indyk. Thus, what was once a nonpartisan policy institute on Middle East matters is now part of the course of largely pro-Israel think tanks. Ladies and gentlemen, your next section of notes, I would call it academia. The lobby has had the most difficult, stifling debate about Israel on college campuses because academic freedom is theoretically a core value and because tenured professors are hard to threaten or silence. Even so, there was only mild criticism of Israel in the 1990s when the Oslo peace process was underway. Criticism rose after that process collapsed and Ariel Sharon came to power in early 2001. And it became especially intense when the IDF reoccupied the West Bank in spring 2002 and employed massive force against the Second Intifada. The lobby moved aggressively to, quote-unquote, take back the campuses. New groups sprang up, like the Caravan for Democracy, which brought Israeli speakers to U.S. colleges. Established groups like the Jewish Council for Public Affairs and Hillel jumped into the fray, and a new group, the Israel on Campus Coalition, was formed to coordinate the many groups that now sought to make Israel's case on campus. Finally, APAC more than tripled its spending for programs to monitor university activities, and to train young advocates for Israel in order to, quote, vastly expand the number of students involved on campus in the national pro-Israel effort. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time, the website hourofthetime.com. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, under academia, we'll continue on. The lobby also monitors what professors write and teach. In September 2002, for example, Martin Kramer and Daniel Pipes, two passionately pro-Israel neoconservatives, established a website, Campus Watch, that posted dossiers on suspect academics and encouraged students to report comments or behavior that might be considered hostile to Israel. This transparent attempt to blacklist and intimidate scholars prompted a harsh reaction, and Pipes and Kramer later removed the dossiers. But the website still invites students to report alleged anti-Israel behavior at U.S. colleges. Groups in the lobby also direct their fire at particular professors and the universities that hire them. Columbia University had the late Palestinian scholar Edward Said on its facility. Has been a frequent target of pro-Israel forces. That's Columbia University and Edward Said. Jonathan Cole, the former Columbia provost, reported that, quote, one can be sure that any public statement in support of the Palestinian people by the preeminent literary critic, Edward Said, will elicit hundreds of emails, letters, and journalistic accounts that call on us to denounce Said and to either sanction or fire him. end quote. That was by Jonathan Cole, the former Columbia provost. When Columbia recruited historian Rashid Khalidi from the University of Chicago, Cole says that, quote, the complaints started flowing in from people who disagreed with the content of his political views, end quote. Princeton faced the same problem a few years later when it considered wooing Khalidi away from Columbia. A classic illustration of the effort to police academia occurred in late 2004, when the David Project, as it was called, David Project, produced a propaganda film alleging that faculty in Columbia University's Middle East Studies program were anti-Semitic and were intimidating Jewish students who defended Israel. Columbia was raked over the coals in pro-Israel circles, but a faculty committee assigned to investigate the charges found no evidence of anti-Semitism, and the only incident worth noting was the possibility that one professor had responded heatedly to a student's question. The committee also discovered that the accused professors had been the target of an overt intimidation campaign. Perhaps, ladies and gentlemen, the most disturbing aspect of this campaign to eliminate criticism of Israel from college campuses is the effort by Jewish groups to push Congress to establish mechanisms that monitor what professors say about Israel. Schools judged to have an anti-Israel bias would be denied federal funding. This effort to get the U.S. government to police campuses have not yet succeeded, but the attempt illustrates the importance pro-Israel groups place on controlling debate on these issues. Finally, a number of Jewish philanthropists have established Israel study programs, in addition to the roughly 130 Jewish studies programs that already exist, so as to increase the number of Israel-friendly scholars on campuses. New York University announced the establishment of the Taub Center for Israel Studies on May 1, 2003. New York University Taub Center, T-A-U-B, Center for Israel Studies, was announced on May 1, 2003, and similar programs have been established at other schools like Berkeley, Brandeis, and Emory. Academic administrators emphasize the pedagogical values of these programs, but the truth is that they are intended in good part to promote Israel's image on campus. Fred Laffer, the head of the Taub Foundation, makes clear that his foundation funded the New York University Center to help counter the, quote, Arabic point of view, end quote, that he thinks is prevalent in New York University's Middle East programs. In sum, ladies and gentlemen, the lobby has gone to considerable lengths to insulate Israel from criticism on college campuses. It has not been as successful in academia as it has been on Capitol Hill, but it has worked hard to stifle criticism of Israel by professors and students, and there is much less of it on campus today. We will leave tonight at that point. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for tuning in to the Hour of the Time, your host here, Doyle Shamley, the 12th of February, 2010, Friday. The website, hourofthetime.com, and I hope everyone has a safe and a studious weekend.